The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
And welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with someone who has been requested many of the previous years, and he was on in 2016 and 2017. No, sorry, 2015 and 16. But ever since then, well, gradually he's gone his own direction away from what was the alt-right. And part of the reason for asking him back is to ask him about that journey, as people say nowadays. So, Richard Spencer, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you, Millennial Woes. It's very good to be back, and I definitely feel at home, I would say that. I haven't strayed too far.
Okay. I guess, obviously, that's a big thing. People wonder. I mean, the big one is supporting Biden.
Joe Biden, yeah.
And obviously, some people say, well, he appeared on CNN as well. I happen to think that was more of a... Well, what do you think about that? I mean, I don't think means a leftist, for example.
Oh, no. I mean, my last television appearance I thought was great, and I think that's probably why I'm not invited back on CNN. So it was in, I think, 2019, and it was in summer or fall of 2019, and I was actually criticizing Trump. And just basically saying that his Twitter account is a toxic brew that is, you know, swilled by your crazy uncle every day. It's merely racist in a way.
I remember yeah. That you said something like it's things that your racist
crazy uncle live tweets. Or, yeah,
after he's had a few drinks or something.
Exactly, and it is. And I was obviously. Extremely disappointed with Trump, although I have a kind of weird I'm almost kind of coming back to Trump, but in a horrible way. Like anyway, we can go into that. But yeah, I thought that was a declaration of independence in many ways. And it was funny because I remember that last one, and they were trying to frame it as like, you know, we've talked to the specialist in radicalization, and we're very concerned about all these young people, and you know, they're getting to drugs or incel them or whatever. And then they played my perspective, and it was like, oh yeah, Trump is actually playing a double game with us. And I don't know, it was a weird, disjointed quality to it all. I think they wanted me to be like, yeah, you know, Baltimore, Maryland is terrible, black people or whatever. And I just was over that. I'm still over all that stuff. Yeah, there's that. But yeah, Biden, I mean, look, I would say up until about October 7th, I would defend Biden as pretty good, in fact. And I know a lot of people really dislike someone saying that, but I think they're trapped in an echo chamber and they really want to hate him and they want to blame him for everything that happens. And they, if he slips on a banana peel, they want to judge him. And I don't. I think pulling out of Afghanistan was really good. It needed to be done, and it was probably implemented in a terrible way, because we've got a bunch of midwits in charge or what have you, you know, whatever Ed Dudden would say. But, you know, it is what it is. Any breakup is going to be inherently terrible. So you just suffer through it and move forward. Stop digging yourself in. I think a lot of domestic policy were good. I remember meeting a kid around a year ago. I was at a New Year's extravaganza thing, and I met this young guy who was just out of college from the University of Washington or something, and he was talking about making six figures in Montana working at a chip or a extreme like molecular level engineering, you know, material plant or something in Montana. And I was like, and he was like, I'm a libertarian, but, you know, this CHIP Act is, you know, I don't know, it's good or something. So I would defend all of that stuff. I would absolutely defend supporting Ukraine also 100%. I will have a hard time supporting Biden this time around because I feel like a lot of things have been revealed about him in the Israel, you know, situation. I don't care about Hunter Biden. I find his personal life, you know, kind of tragic, but also rather amusing on another level. I don't care about any of that stuff. Corruption is just, you know, it's politics. I mean, I don't know what to say. But I really think that Biden has shown his age. People of his generation, I think, are still trapped in a kind of World War II Holocaust paradigm when thinking about these things. So in a way, I almost forgive him because he can't think his way out of it. But I think this idea of being so trying to bring back some normalcy to the country, being kind of vaguely patriotic in the way that he is, while tolerating all the stuff that we hate. But, you know, I thought all of that's good, but just basically endorsing, looking the other way, explaining away what is just clearly a policy of ethnic cleansing on behalf of Israel, of Gaza, and perhaps even more, dragging us back into a George W. Bush paradigm in the Middle East. I mean, in many ways, George W. Bush was actually, I mean, I say this, I can't believe I'm saying this, actually. George W. Bush was much better, in fact, much more humane and sensible on the Palestinian question than Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken have been. So I just feel this is a huge blunder. I think it's going to be catastrophically bad, and I'm morally outraged by it. So I'm really not going to be doing the whole, you know, dark Biden wearing sunglasses. I just can't bring myself to do that. I would defend a lot of what he did. I think it was all okay. And I'm in a way glad that I just got out of the Trump thing, which I did genuinely feel was rather toxic. But yeah, I'm just I'm in a kind of weird, ambivalent place right now in terms of politics.
I thought so. There are a few nuances to pick up on. But just quickly, I do remember I saw a clip of you at the end, after the Biden's election, and you were talking about the end days of Trump. And I mean, I've got it. I could just play it, but it's you're talking about Christian evangelists speaking in tongues. You remember this?
Yes. They're coming from Africa. They're coming from Asia. Yeah, it was. I mean, that's what it became. I mean, it's just. I've got to say,
there's something about, and I'm not saying that I support Biden or whatever. I don't. But there is something about right-wingers and quality control. I'm thinking also about Tucker Carlson. When they've got a good thing going, it's got great potential, and then somehow it hits the rocks and they just don't make the right decisions. I think Tucker's show on Twitter, I mean, when you start talking about Obama having sex with some guy in the late 90s, I just think it's absolutely tawdry and low grade, and no one cares. No one cares,
and it seems extremely dubious. He's like, let's take the word of a convicted con artist on
exactly
Obama being gay in the 90s. It's like, oh, give me a fucking break.
It's just nonsense. So that kind of thing. And I saw something from Tucker, and I like Tucker. You know, I really do. I used to actually really enjoy watching his Fox News show. I saw another thing today. I can't remember what it was, but it was also something sort of preposterous and silly. And that's what
Frank Underwood
also said today, that he didn't want to identify as white. He doesn't care about that kind of stuff. This kind of nonsense. But to get back to Trump, towards the end there, it did just seem to be shambolic. So 4 years, 5 years earlier, there had been such energy and optimism and apparent resourcefulness. And now it's this kind of nonsense. And I did find the clip of that woman, the evangelist, and it's absolutely bizarre to think of that at a political
conference. She was his spiritual advisor. It's not like she was just a Trump fan. She was in with Trump, and he was signing off on this stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's you can play it if you want or not. We don't have to revisit those painful times. it's up to you.
I think it would rip us out of the
okay.
The floor
yeah,
thing. But I've yeah. got the clip of you talking about it. I've got the clip of her actually doing the speaking in tongues, and then I've got a clip of someone remixed that. So someone's
all right. Well, now that you've set it up, you can play it. We can.
Oh, well. If you insist,
yes.
Which one do you want?
I want to see the remix. That's kind of funny.
Okay, let me see if I can find it. It might take a minute, but I think this is a thing with right wingers, and I don't really know why it happens. But Trump just seemed to completely lose the plot towards the end. I don't know how that happened. Hold on.
Well, I can talk about that.
Yeah, you talk about that.
I mean, I don't know if there was a plot to begin with. And I do think that Jeb Bush was accurate at the very least when he said, please clap, of course, but also when he said he's the chaos candidate. And there isn't a whole lot of there. I think you can go back to Trump, even his book from 2000 or 2001 called The Country We Deserve, where he talks about national industrial policy and national healthcare policy. And he's basically a kind of liberal without the liberalism. You know, it's like, let's do the kind of 90s liberalism thing, and let's support unions and car auto workers and give everyone healthcare and have a good country, but be patriotic and about it. I think there's some redeemable Buchananite impulse there. I mean, but it is absolutely a personality cult, and I don't think he could get away from that, because that bug is a feature. Like, he's only going to win through that. He's only going to, and I've seen him doing this a lot recently. You know, around a year ago, he gave an announcement speech at Mar-a-Lago that was typical Republican stuff. It was just low energy, risible. In fact, Jeb Bush could have given the speech and no one would have noticed. But what I think he recognizes in his gut, and I'm not sure people around him fully recognize this. Maybe they do, but I actually would give credit to Trump for this. I think he knows it in that lizard brain of his, that you've got to call upon some sort of dark energy to win. Like, you have to be the bad guy. And you have to say the immigrants are poisoning our blood. You have to go and just say, like, all everything you see in the media, it's not real. It's all fake and it's sinister and so on. And they're trying to sacrifice me because they want to kill you. And also, I mean, from the very beginning, Michael Moore said this and he was correct. There's this fuck you energy that defines voting for Trump. You know, I'm homeless, or I just got a divorce and lost my job and fucking hell. But, you know, on this November 8th or whenever it is, like, I am as powerful as Jeff Bezos. We have the same amount of power on that for that one moment. And I can just say, fuck you, world. Fuck you, boss. Fuck you, ex-wife. Fuck you, my crazy kid who has blue hair and a nosy earring. Fuck you all. I am voting for Trump. That is how he wins. Like, it's not a bug. All the liberals who are, like, terrified of all this stuff and, you know, like, wringing their hands, they also sense it in their gut that that's how he accomplishes his goals, or at the very least gets elected. So there's no there. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, we gave into the chaos and loved it, and it was hilarious and fun. There was all this Dionysian energy around the alt-right in 2016, you know, the Pepe gas chamber memes, just crazy, you know, bombastic and outlandish claims. I mean, it was fun. It was crazy. We're all drunk. But I do think that at some point when you're in office, there needs to be a there. And all of Trump's policies were either incoherent or they were just conservative policies. And so it really was a disappointment. It was a profound disappointment. But I will give him this. He's tapping into the dark side once again. And he knows it. You know, it's like how an organism survives is what it will repeatedly do. You know, like if you get chicks by wearing a crazy blue hat, then you're going to wear a crazy blue hat. If, you know, et cetera, a criminal, it's worked. I've never gotten caught. I keep stealing from this liquor store and I keep getting away with it. I'm going to keep doing it. This is how I survive. This is, you know, and he's an organism like that. He survives politically by tapping into dark energy, and he's going to do it again. And I think he is doing it. And that's why I think he's actually going to win.
A question that I had for later on. Is he going to be on the ballot? And if so, will he win? I think the answer to both of those is yes. As an outsider, a layman to all this, that's how it seems. I'd be amazed if this time next year he's not the president. What's the term? President in waiting?
President-elect, yes.
President-elect. But let us now play. I think her name is Paula White.
Paula White, yes. Aptly named. Paula and White is just kind of like perfect.
Yeah, this is from the dark days of the end of Trump's campaign to get reelected in 2020. Yeah. Here we go.
Strike and strike and strike and strike until you have victory. For every enemy that is aligned against you, let there be that we would strike the ground, for you will give us victory. I hear a sound of abundance of rain. I hear a sound of victory. The Lord says it is done. The Lord says it is done. I hear a sound of abundance of rain. I hear a sound of victory. Angels are being released right now. Angels are being dispatched right now.
There we go. It goes on somewhat like that for another minute. That is just insane, isn't it?
It is. It's also, I say this as a cultural Protestant, I guess I could say. You know, there was such promise in bringing the word to the world. Like, you can read the text for yourself. It's not in Latin, it's not in Hebrew, it's not in Greek, or et cetera. You can read it and interpret it and understand the Gospels for yourself. And the word is it. And then this like 500-year history of Protestantism descending into gibberish. I mean, it's almost, I don't know, it's perfect or telling. They've lost the word. They're speaking. I mean, what is even the justification for this? Are they speaking the language of angels or Hebrew, or what are they, hell are they doing? I have no idea.
I did know at some point, but I think it's supposed to be that they're possessed by something that's so powerful, it's overwhelmed, that their brain cannot contain, it's so complicated.
Right.
Sort of thing. So, but I don't know.
But the word, but just delving into that drunken Dionysian energy and just losing yourself. You're not an individual anymore. You're no longer Paula White, you know, wearing kind of sexy yoga attire and you know, taking money from your congregation. You've just become this like undifferentiated mass of energy and drunkenness. It's like descending. It ends in death, I presume. I mean, just the total, you know, returning to the life force itself. It's madness. Again, I hate it. I despise it. In fact, it drives me crazy. But I mean, you're gonna in order for Trump to win, he's going to have to call upon something like that, as bad as it is. It's probably why I'm not president, and he is. I'm not willing to do that. He is. And he is able also to call upon those forces in a way. So I do think he's an amazing figure. And I think we live in his age. It's the Trump age.
Yeah. I guess an interesting question then is, why did he lose in 2020? I mean, it looks to me like the election was pretty heavily rigged. But I think you don't believe that.
Well, I believe it to some extent. I mean, there was COVID, and so there was that as an excuse. A friend of mine has actually mentioned this to me, and he is much more than I am involved in just Republican political engineering. And he said that it is correct when Democrats say this. If all votes are counted, Democrats are going to win most every election, particularly the national ones. And the fact is, tons of votes don't get counted because they show up late. They don't fill in their name. They don't bring their ID or whatever. Or there's some Republican trick of like moving precincts too far away from black neighborhoods. I mean, they've been doing this for decades and they're still doing it now. They're effectively a bunch of racist individuals. But if all the votes were one day counted, the Democrats would sweep the country. And I do think that it was rigged in that extent. Basically giving people total leeway to fill out everything improperly, to vote from home, et cetera, to harvest these ballots. I don't like it. I think people should vote on the day. And your only excuse is like, I don't know, a hospitalization or you're abroad for the military or something. I just think it's like a game. You know, if your quarterback is sick and he can't play, he doesn't play. You still play the game. Yeah.
You can't provide for every eventuality such that there will be no injustice at all.
Right.
I agree with you. It should be ID at the police, and it should be on the day. And if you can't vote, if those requirements are too stringent, tough. That would be the way.
I totally agree. So in that sense, it was rigged. Now, the Sidney Powell stuff, the voting machines, and I mean, look, it's fascinating, but I don't buy it at all. Those people strike me as also deranged, and I'm just, you know, no. But I do get that. Like, it was definitely rigged on their behalf. Now, are they going to do something like that again, or is Trump going to be able to call upon enough madness in order to overshadow that? And has Biden demoralized his own voters? I mean, I think that's the real issue with Israel. Because before October 7th, I would actually say that Biden, despite his incipient senility and gaffes and whatever, I think he was just rolling into victory, as Trump was in a way in late 2019, before COVID changed a lot of things. And you can't demoralize your own base. And if you start the Israel thing, really is, I mean, 65%, close to a majority of Republicans want a ceasefire. It's basically old Republicans who are just hardcore, you know, do what you want. A strong majority of Democrats want a ceasefire, want a just fundamentally different policy with Israel. And the old, it's like his age caught up to him. He's living in a different paradigm, and it just doesn't work anymore for his voting bloc.
It seems to me that his cabinet, not so much Biden himself, but it seems to me that the cabinet, that whole administration, are trying to calm Netanyahu down because they can see how bad it is in terms of PR. It's bad for the Israelis, and it's bad for anyone who's seen supporting the Israelis. I mean, you don't want to be seen supporting ethnic cleansing. It's a pretty bad thing.
Look, you know, we've lived through something. I mean, I can remember back in the 90s when I was a young adult and I was kind of watching. I would watch the McLaughlin Group. I actually loved that. And, you know, I would watch CNN or et cetera. And there was just a total blissful absence of any criticism. Even there was coverage, I guess, of the Middle East. There was just a absence of criticism of Israel. And you saw that even in the 2000s. I remember watching when I was young, and I actually supported John Kerry in 2004 for what that. So I, in a way, the Biden thing wasn't that terribly unusual. But I remember watching like Keith Olbermann and all those people. They would be totally liberal on some things. They would be like, you know, this fascist Trump, you know, he wants people to die because they don't have health insurance. And, you know, they were just full on, you know, like social Democrats. And Israel, it was like, well, thankfully, Israel survived another rocket attack and they've killed yet more, Hamas terrorists. So, you know, it was pro-Israel. And what I've noticed over the last really 5 years, and I think this has a lot to do with DEI and diversity, actually, it's one of those like contradictions of the regime of seeing, I mean, I don't have cable or anything like that, but just seeing a clip of like Mehdi Hassan or some of these people offering like very, you know, very fair, but substantial criticism of Israel and really getting to the core of it. Talking about 1948, talking, you know, 1967, all this stuff. Suez, I mean, historically informed, serious criticism that was just absent. It was maybe present in academia in some circles, but it was absent from the mainstream. And so I think Israel might be acting to a very large degree, or Bibi Netanyahu might be acting a very large degree out of a sort of desperation. He understands that there's a season for everything. And this season is coming to a close, and it's not going to work again. You can't keep doing this. And so you've got to just strike while the iron is hot. You have Biden in office, you have Blinken, they're not going to say no. They might very well like tiptoe around it and, you know, and I think genuinely they do not want to see civilian casualties. I mean, they're not monsters, but they'll never say no. They're, you know, and so you've just got to do it and strike while the iron is hot, because this season is ending. And
I agree. I think this was probably Israel's last chance to get away with doing this. The way it seems to me is that this is a, if you want to speak about generations, I don't know how fond you are of the generational stuff. I can't remember, but the millennials, Gen X, even Gen X, are not as obsessed with the Holocaust as the boomers are.
No.
And then the zoomers don't give a shit at all.
They literally don't believe in the Holocaust. I mean, like, I don't know if you saw that. I mean, it's shocking even to my mind. Like 20% of them think it's fake or something. And I don't even think they're reading Holocaust revisionism. I don't know. Are they 20%?
Maybe it just seems far-fetched to them, just on the face of it.
They're disconnected from reality itself. I have no idea. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm older than you are, but we experienced peak Holocaust. And, you know, in the 90s, I remember everyone had to go see Schindler's List and so on. And schools.
I somehow got out of it, actually. Maybe that's where I went wrong.
Well, yeah.
Everyone was, I get the point.
Right.
Sorry to interrupt.
The full title is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and it's really good. It's, you know, just try it. It'll, you know, it's a fun ride. I guess that I was making a joke there, but that movie actually is about the Holocaust, interestingly. I think Spielberg was better when he did metaphors. Schindler's List, not my favorite film.
It was definitely a film that I think he felt there's a sort of solemnness about it, which is understandable given the subject matter. But
sure.
I think the way he's talked about it, things that he said, it seems that it was almost after all the fun, here's me giving something back to my people, and here's me doing right by my people by making this film. And it certainly did have a huge effect. I was too young before that to know how big a hold the Holocaust had. But after Schindler's List, it was, it was everywhere. It was just
The Oscars. A lot of education became about the Holocaust. And I don't think the Zoomers being Holocaust deniers is a good thing, because it's bizarre. I don't know what they, for them, what Academic Agent does, these kind of like ongoing jokes where he'll do these like absurd Jesus Christ, as you might have known, was born in 1950 in Ohio in the United States. He was a white man, and he became our savior, and he played quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. That's almost what they believe. And it's deeply concerning, in fact. I think it's good not to be weighed down, certainly by the Holocaust, and have this like moral weight on your shoulders. That's fine. But it's not like they're overcoming that. They're dissociated from reality. But I do think that means that the myths aren't going to work with them. You know, I mean, they see images on Instagram of a baby who's lost his legs and on a hospital floor. I mean, tell me another tale about, 1945, and they just don't want to hear it. It doesn't work. And so I think we've exited a paradigm, and I think that's remarkable.
Absolutely. And I've seen similar things from Palestine, from the Gaza conflict, and it's just appalling. The injuries to children is absolutely awful. And everyone knows war is hell, war is like this, it's obviously going to happen. But I think there's a sense that it's happening far too much, and that it's all quite deliberate. I mean, they're not trying to end a conflict, they're trying to end a people. That's how it seems. And they're basically saying that. They want them dispersed all over Europe and whatever. So they simply won't exist anymore as a people. Unless it's going to be diaspora Palestinians, which I don't know. That doesn't seem likely.
It is. It is genocide. I mean, it's not, it's not like a, it's not the Holocaust. Obviously, things are different. Although, I do think there's some very curious things about it. Some of these images of rounding up people, putting them into a, there's one image of they're in this pit. There was like a bombed out area. They are, in a weird way, actually reiterating the Holocaust. And you can kind of understand that psychologically in a couple of different ways. Because, I mean, they've done to the Jews what people say the Germans did to the Jews they've done to the Palestinians what people say the Germans did to the Jews, in the sense of utterly demonizing them and just removing any sort of empathy that's possible. And they are, again, psychologically, what is it? Is that, are you an abused child? Hurt people. You've suffered this and now you're lashing out. Okay, that's fair. Maybe a little bit generous. Are you, in a way, kind of waving it in people's faces, in the sense of saying that, no, we can actually do this? And I mean, maybe there's a little bit of both going on there. But it's a genocide. They're attacking, there's reports of them attacking intellectuals. They've been attacking journalists. They have been attacking hospitals, claiming that their bunkers are just ridiculous nonsense like that. Whatever word you want to use, it is a systematic destruction of this people that's happening before our eyes, and people are excusing it. At the end of the day, people like Joe Biden. So it's,
And it's not even veiled. I mean, they're saying it quite openly that they want this complete change of that area. Here's a question that I wanted to put to you, because I heard you saying this about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and I thought that's a very interesting statement, and we've kind of touched on it. Don't worry, it's just about the Jews.
Oh, okay, sure.
There's nothing controversial.
Meth is actually good in moderation. Like, you're like, a very interesting statement. Yeah.
No, it was that Jewish power in America peaked in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And you were saying it approximately, but I've always wanted to ask you to elaborate on that, because a lot of people think that it was still very powerful, up until now, and now it's a bit more visible that they've lost power. But you go into that.
Well, what I was saying, and I think we have touched on this, I think Jewish power is mythical power. It's a power of a story or a narrative, as what people would usually use instead of the word story. But that's the essence of it, and that's where they're most powerful. It's not really about money, and it's not about Israel being well-armed and being able to do those things. Those are sources of power, but like the real power is the myth. And if you are mythically valorized, you're untouchable. And no one thinks outside the paradigm. I mean, when people went on CNN in 2001, it's not even that like they were actively censoring critics of Israel or something. No one even thought to do it. I mean, there was you couldn't find a mainstream person who would offer serious criticism. That's real power. And that doesn't quite last forever. I think there's a real cycle to it. So, I mean, I've definitely talked with some people. I'm thinking right now of this rather liberal friend of mine she's almost gone into like depression, and I mean not personal depression, but just this like there's nothing we can do. We can't stop them. They're just gonna wipe out these people before our eyes and send us the bill later. And I get that. And I understand why people would feel that. But I see it a little bit differently and a little bit, I guess, optimistically, in the sense that the need to lash out like this, the need to assert power and these Israelis going on social media and just like bragging about killing people, dehumanizing babies, dancing with a gun on top of rubble. That's not good optics. That is really bad optics. It's kind of triumphalist, I guess, but it's really, really bad. And the fact that they're doing that and that they feel that they need to resort to that, I think is a sign of inner weakness. You know, it's like, remember, the peak is when you start declining. You know, that it might feel like you can't be beaten at the peak, but that's actually the moment when you've lost it. And I think Israel has totally lost the script. I think within our lifetime, the blue Star of David is going to have the same significance as the Nazi swastika. It's going to be taboo and tasteless. Now, I really believe that, because this thing is not ending and it's going to get worse. And I do see that Jewish power is waning, and it's almost waning. It's ruined by its success. It's waning due to its triumph. And so I do find it, whatever I support in the Middle East, putting that aside, I find it kind of fascinating just to look at and analyze, like looking at it objectively. We're seeing an end to a paradigm and flipping into something else. And I think that's exciting, actually.
Oh, I definitely agree. One thing is to speak separately of Zionism, Zionist power, and Jewish diaspora. The college liberal, the professor, who's all into feminism, multiculturalism, and all the rest of it. Would you say that that is the same power, the same entity in the world, or would you say that those are two separate power centers?
It's the same power, yes.
Right.
It is Judaism. Yes.
Of course.
It can be contradictory. I mean, keep in mind, like the book of Judges, just as an example, is a book about like falling away from Yahweh and Yahweh getting pissed and knocking their lights out as a result. And sometimes Yahweh going to Gentiles and allowing them to rise up. And, those two things, that liberal professor who might very well be protesting on behalf of a ceasefire, to his credit, and Bibi Netanyahu, the hardest core, at least with political power, they are the same thing. And but it doesn't mean that they can't kind of be in contradiction on some level, and one can't undermine the other, which I think is happening. But this is not new. I mean, they're fascinating people.
I'm just wondering if, let's say that Zionism, and as you say, the blue star, the Star of David, that becomes reviled, does that mean that liberal, progressive Jews in the West are going to lose their cultural influence.
Maybe to a degree, but I would say ultimately no. And I mean, this is something that Mark Brahman really developed this theory, but it's the notion of a proto-Jew. And he also has a notion of a post-Jew. And so at some point, the brand, if you will, of Judaism is going to be so toxic that they won't adopt it. But it doesn't mean that they're going to, you know, just become whites or et cetera. Yeah, they're going to still be it's a brand change. And again, one of the kind of radical things of his theory is that there've been a lot of brand changes. I mean, Judaism is the one right now, but yeah, there's also, you could say liberalism, but there's also Thonic cults. There's the cults of Saturn. There are cults of Hephaestus or Vulcan, et cetera. I mean, Yahweh himself is basically a volcanic god. He's a fire god. I mean, I think that's clearly expressed in the Bible. So like they're wily ones. They're going to find a new way out of this. And I think that's why it's important to, you know, criticize Jews, not just as people. I mean, I think, you know, most Jews that I meet are totally, you know, fine people. I might disagree, agree, etc. I think you really have to criticize them on a mythical level. I don't think Jews are really a race. I think that's a mistake that a lot of people made. You can probably find a genetic, genetic line that stretches this way and that, but I think that's almost more deceptive than anything. It really is the Torah. That's what makes them a Jew, and their myths and stories and their ability to bring the word to new populations and psychologically dominate and control people. That's their power. That's what you have to go after. And just thinking of them as kind of like, you know, they're bad people or they're, I think that's actually wrong. I think the racial antagonism towards Jews leads to a lot of misunderstandings. You have to go to the heart of their power, and that is this book that remains sacred and has continued to inform everything we do and think, including my own mind. I think that's the real big kahuna, is to go to the very source of their power. And it's not AIPAC and it's not Joe Lieberman or whatever, to pull a almost meaningless example out of the hat. They're right when they say it's the Pentateuch.
I think in terms of the racial genetic angle, there's no question that the Ashkenazi have a genetic profile that can be identified to such an extent that 23andMe can tell you how Ashkenazi you are in terms of as a percentage. But that is a specific thing. That's a specific strand within the Jewish people, the Ashkenazi. Sephardic, as far as I know, I don't know, but I don't think there is. I mean, you never hear about a Sephardic genetic profile, is it? Maybe there is one. I don't know. But I do understand what you're saying, that it's really a psychological, some might say spiritual thing, mm-hmm. Where they are galvanized by a heritage of many, many, many centuries and get into this. And undoubtedly, the Ashkenazi racial thing will be relevant. But I think first and foremost, they see themselves as a spiritual entity in the world. I'm not sure what to say about that. I think it seems to me that this is, I'm just thinking about British hate speech laws. You know, mm-hmm. What can I say here that this is so annoying?
Well, in a way, what I'm saying is fairly politically correct I'm not saying that to be politically correct. I think it is in a way good news, because if you can, attack the sin and not the sinner, so to speak. Like you go after. They're powerful because of their literature. I mean, it's kind of crazy to even, we whites just are so fearful of saying things like this because we're just kind of Philistines, to use a biblical metaphor. We don't, you know, it's like, oh, that Shakespeare stuff. What is that, gay? Or, you know, reading something in Latin. Who was that Destiny guy who thought the Bible was written in English or Latin or
I've forgotten what it was, but yeah, he makes these obvious, like, that betray an incredible level of ignorance.
Of ignorance, yeah.
About general stuff. It's really something else.
But he's debating you on something that he knows. He knows, like, the little tip of the iceberg, and he's, like, firing off, missiles left and right.
The first paragraph in the Wikipedia page.
Yeah. Studies have shown. where was I in this? Yeah, it's like it's a literary thing. That's the source of their power. And so go after the literature. You know, you don't, it's kind of PC, I guess, but I'm not a very PC person. It's like, that's the source of their power. And that's a monumental power to be able to bring the word to someone and to influence their mind psychologically for centuries and for them not to be aware, for them to think that they thought these thoughts on their own, in fact. That's true power. And I think that's the only level to really attack them. It's not personal. You know, I can criticize Israel's foreign policy, you know, all I want, but that's not really getting at the heart of it, you know, and it's certainly not about attacking people, day-to-day people, you know, so on.
As individuals. That's retarded. It's an interesting thing that he said, that white people are scared of speaking in these terms because it's kind of woo-woo. There's the high culture aspect of it first and then the sort of magical aspect of it. I think this is a very good point. I think there's a lot of kind of autism in white people, especially white men, obviously. I won't claim to be entirely immune to it or free of it myself, but it just seems to be a thing that colors the whole way that we look at the world. And it's one of the things that enables other groups to take advantage, because we can't see in group terms. We see as individual, this person's just doing this. It's quite rational for him to do this. So of course he's doing this, but we don't see the cumulative effect of it. And this also goes for culture and changing images, changing symbols, because we don't see that they are symbols and that symbols have power. Mm-hmm. But I think other ethnic groups have always realized this, have always known this. Mm. And this is why a lot of brand changes happen. A lot of symbol changes happen. Even just changing a word can change the connotations of it.
Yes, no doubt.
Yeah, it's an obscure thing, so I can't come up with examples off the cuff, but it's something that I definitely think happens. There are quite a lot of things to pick up on, but I guess we should get to what people will want us to talk about, which is, I hope we've satisfied them so far, but nonetheless, the thing that will be of interest to people most of all is what happened with you and the alt-right. How do you now feel? How does that era fit into your life retrospectively? What was going on there?
I have a lot of ambivalence about the whole thing. I have some bitterness, and I also do have some good memories as well. So it was a crazy time, and I think we all felt so euphoric that, you know, to do things that I certainly wouldn't do now, like the Hail Trump at the end of the speech or something. Yeah, you're wearing the purple shirt from perhaps the exact one, unwashed, in fact, from...
No, it's a new one. Okay. Bob Richard, come on.
it was like the more outlandish, the better, because we were just winning. So I certainly would not say Hail Trump now, but at the time... There was just something in the air that we felt invincible and everything that we did, you know, again, the crazier the better. I think this kind of goes back to that, you know, Dionysian drunken feeling. I would say that I do feel bitter in the sense that I'll be frank. I felt scapegoated by the movement to a very large degree. And, you know, as they say, you know, if you're the starting pitcher or the quarterback, you get more credit than you deserve, and then you get more blame. And I was, due to a number of different factors, the media's choice as front man. You know, they kind of loved to hate me, or they found me interesting, or I was just simply willing to talk to them, or whatever. I danced to their tune. So, I mean, all of that is kind of correct. So I understand it, but this notion that the alt-right was on the verge of victory and I snatched it from them by ordering them to attend Charlottesville or whatever, I just find extremely unfair. And it also, when you start engaging in the sort of scapegoating, it prevents you from having a serious retrospective look at what we actually did do wrong, what I did wrong and what a lot of people did wrong, and also inherent problems of why, if we were given the opportunity again, we would do the same damn thing. And so, yeah, as you can tell, I think I've expressed some ambivalence, some this, I love you, you're my hero, or no, now I hate you, you ruined everything, or whatever. That turning on a dime of people, really, it bothered me. It made me not very willing to trust a lot of people. And it just, it is what it is. But I guess the lesson I learned, a couple, because I don't want to dwell on any sort of ambivalence, is that, you know, as I was saying with Trump, there wasn't any there. There wasn't any real coherent policy to enact. There was just conservative stuff. Or maybe at the tail end, there was a weird Ron Paulism that entered. He actually sent out a memo about removing military bases abroad, and it was just ignored because it was too outrageous, by Douglas MacGregor, I believe. But there wasn't really any there, and so there wasn't any ability to build on it. And there's all these kind of right-wing populist movements that come and go, you know, Buchananism in the 90s into the 2000s, Ron Paulism, Trump, etc. And Ron Paul, I guess to his credit, they have the most lasting institutions, if the least lasting influence. I don't think libertarianism is going to catch fire anytime soon. And so if there isn't anything there, you can't build on it. And I think with the people, you know, Mark Brahman in particular, that we've had a ongoing friendship for well over a decade. And we also have a kind of intellectual friendship, in the sense that we're very different people, but we kind of are bouncing off one another and reinforcing and challenging one another, etc. I feel like you need to start building a intellectual foundation that you can build upon later and that can actually go somewhere. And if you don't have it, it's going to be the burnout cycle again and again and again. A lot of the things that I felt happened to me in terms of scapegoating or turncoat behavior happened to Nick Fuentes, maybe even on a larger scale, because Nick Fuentes is more popular than I am. And it's going to continue to happen. It happened with the Kanye stuff from a year ago. It's this burnout cycle again and again of extreme euphoria and then depression and scapegoating and then you just start it up again, and it doesn't really build. Where has the Buchananite movement from the 90s? Where is that now? What foundation or institution or serious thought, intellectual school has that produced? And that is the only way to fundamentally move forward and change. There was a lot of leftists laboring away in obscurity for a long time, and they felt like they had just no chance of victory whatsoever. You know, what these guys are going to abdicate after losing a world war? Yeah, tell me another one. That's crazy. I've got to go scribble away and do my work in Marxism, for example, until we can build a literature and a school that can actually inform a politics in the future. And right-wingers just don't like this. Right-wingers think that, like, if Joe Biden wins in 2024, like, their own daughter is going to, like, become a man or something. Like, it's just like the worst thing you could imagine is just gonna happen, like November 9th, you know. And it's not gonna happen, actually. It's okay, it's gonna be fine. And but we're not okay in the sense that there's no intellectual school that we can point to that is going anywhere. And so in my own small way, I've just decided to forego any like big stuff. I mean, look, if I said I'm going to go march on Charlottesville tomorrow, I don't think anyone would show up anyway. So I don't even think I'm in a position to like call upon the masses and, you know, arise, you know, my underlings. It's not going to happen. But I don't want it to happen. And so like what I can do that's unique, I think a lot of other people can go and talk to the media or be funny or be outlandish or whatever. But what I can do that's unique is to really go there in terms of cultural criticism, religious criticism, etc. I'm willing to do the things that others aren't, and I'm able to do things that others aren't. And so I just see that as it's a necessity, but it's also an ideal. You have to labor in obscurity for a bit. And you have to kind of say no to some things. I think we said yes to everything with Trump in 2016 because it's like, yeah, just say yes because it's fun. We're winning. Everything works out. Well, it didn't really work out, or at least for me. There's a necessity of attempting to create a school, but I think there's also an ideal. And so, yeah, I mean, in some ways, my like arrogance or ambition or outlandishness hasn't ceased. I do want to complete a project begun with Nietzsche of a full dismantling of Judeo-Christianity. And I do want to, in fact, with Brahman and company, as just absurd as this sounds, start a new religion in the sense of start a new spiritual process that will animate institutions in the future. So I'm no less like arrogant and delusional and bombastic. I've kept all of that. I am who I am, but you've just got to do it in a different lane. And going out in front, you know, endorsing candidates, jumping on their coattails, etc. I felt like that brought me more pain than it brought me some joy. And it brought some joy. I have a little bit of nostalgia, but it ultimately brought me disappointment and pain and frustration. And so I kind of touched the stove and I'm not going to touch it again.
Seemed like it did. You did seem to be having fun. I mean, like from looking at you during that time, you seem to be enjoying yourself. You seem to be on a high. Just as an observation. But of course, I understand there are always multiple things going on. There are quite a few things for me to pick up on there that you've said. And it's very interesting to hear this. One of them is, I think that a problem that you faced is a problem that other people have also faced in the movement, which is, if you are visible, then people think that you are a leader, and therefore they think that you are trained in that. In fact, a lot of us were ordinary people. There's a thing about, what were you before this? Before this strange episode? Well, mm-hmm. I was just an ordinary guy. I worked in a library or whatever. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a... So not everyone is trained in and thought that this would be where they would what they would one day be doing. So they didn't spend their lifetime preparing for it, and other people didn't prepare them for it. And then you find yourself in this position. You're visible, you're articulate, charismatic, you have an original perspective, and therefore people think that you can lead 1,000 men. But that's a completely different thing. It's a completely different thing. But then you feel the pressure to do it because you're in that position and there's no one else there. There's no one else to do it. So it does fall to you. And then there's that. But, well, we don't get to
I think I'm better as a contrarian. You know, I'm better. I'm kind of better as a that's kind of more natural for me. I don't think I'll ever go invisible because I you know, it's the cat's already out of the bag and I don't like hiding. I don't, you know, but I think I'm better suited as a contrarian who's going to kind of drive you crazy a little bit because I need to, you know, I'm the contrarian you deserve.
Okay. I would agree with you certainly that the alt-right was a huge release of energy, and it was great. It was really, I mean, I think loads of people, everyone came to it from a different thing. And for me, it was great because there was a sense of purpose and direction and that you could be part of something. So it was great fun. And, you know, I think loads of people, I experienced that. I witnessed this a lot. People will talk fondly of 2016. Who weren't even at the conference or the other things that were going on. So I remember
it was just nuts. I mean, it's things that look okay. I mean, I remember a woman who was even plausibly going to interview me, and we said hello. And then we started making out, and then we just made love immediately. And that it was like I had jumped into the shoes of my childhood hero, Roger Moore. Like it was like a, it was like being in a, you know, it's like, oh, well, I guess we have some time to waste, don't we? I mean, it's insane. And I don't even, I'm not really, I guess I'm bragging a little bit, to be honest, but bear with me.
It's a good thing to brag. I mean, it's funny.
Everyone should brag to a degree, but it's not, that's not going to happen again. Like, you know, I mean, like it was, but it also proves the point of this just euphoric insanity that was present at that time. That was capturing everyone. It was bigger than a single person. And so it was I don't think I could ever denounce the time, or, you know, I think I probably should release a certain kind of apology that's also an apologia, that is a kind of justification thing for something, but also like a, this is what I've learned, but also a defense, to be frank. You know, I'm not in a court of law. I don't need to defend myself to the hilt. I can reveal some warts and scars and, you know, and lessons learned and all that kind of stuff. But I think it should be defended. It was what it was. But I guess the real issue is, can you self-critically examine that? Do you want to try to recapture that moment where like any woman would make love to you at a drop of a hat or something? Well, that's, you know, I hate to say it, Richard, but you know that you peaked. Might not happen again, my friend. You know, and maybe it shouldn't happen again. But you know, you just have to you have to be aware of that and be able to critically examine it and understand how great it was and understand the real serious problems of it. And I hope I am doing that.
Yeah. And did she go on to interview you?
Well, it was an interview of sorts.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Yes. I examined her briefs and it was.
Excellent. But yeah, the thing is, it's the, I mean, to some extent, that was
this person who did that also denounced, like, I remember seeing something like 9 months later, like making fun of me. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like, but that it's telling these things. You got to learn that, you know, money doesn't last forever. Fun women, cheap women, they don't last forever. Some things don't last forever. But other things do, and you've got to kind of learn that as well. Victor, you know, the high school quarterback who was the greatest in his state and got all the chicks and was amazing is now, you know, when he turns 40, he's working as a mechanic. And maybe some people can't take that damage to the ego. It is hard, you know, but then I think some of the better ones kind of can, and they can kind of see, like, it was great, but it's also fleeting. And, you know, that I think that's kind of what you have to do, but it's hard. It's hard. We all have egos. We all want to be, well, not everyone, I guess, but a lot of us want to be the star, and et cetera. And sometimes you're not going to be the star, and you've got to accept that, as painful as it is.
Yeah. I think the best way is to have a certain detachment, a certain distance from it, and see it as kind of funny almost.
Yeah.
But even though it was serious and you took it seriously. I think with you, there must have been that, and I don't want to go too much into this, it's just an observation from what you've said, that there must have been the bad boy thing. Yeah, I think women must have seen you as, I mean, at one point you were the number one hate figure in America.
Really. Dangerous man. Yeah. Nothing's more erotic than being dangerous. Yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, women write letters to serial killers. I mean, it's a horrible thing in a way, but
yeah, it's a very strange thing. It's very revealing of the female psyche, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, a few other points to pick up on. It was a huge release of energy, but therefore it was inherently undisciplined. I don't know if you could, I don't think if anyone could have disciplined it. But the lack of discipline was both it was certainly a weakness, but it was also a strength, because if you see, from my point of view, obviously you can understand why their ideology, a set of policies, that would have been helpful. It would have been clarifying. But it would also have been limiting. It would also have been a bit of a bummer.
Yeah.
And I just remembered, if I might quote Mussolini, our program is simple. We want to rule Italy. And in a sense, right. That reminds me of, I'm not saying that we were fascists or whatever, but I think a lot of people are like this. A lot of groups of all persuasions are like this. Basically, we just want to rule, and we're happy for other people similar to us to rule. But it's more of a mentality thing than an ideology thing. So let's just get into power. And this is what Academic Agent has, this is his sort of thing as well. That really it's just about getting into power, and then you can work out the actual ideology, the actual policies and so on. That's just a thing. It's a possible thing. And then the other thing is that the lack of discipline is a weakness because it makes you vulnerable and people can make accusations about what you believe and so on. But also because people who get involved in such a thing, free thinkers, tend to be disagreeable and therefore they tend to be antisocial. And I think both you and I have experienced this kind of thing. So that then leads to chaos and vulnerability for the whole. So I
could go. I mean, I basically endorse what you said. Yes, because there's an inherently antisocial quality to being far right in this day and age, and it's going to attract sociopaths and psychopaths and various personality disorders. And you could fairly say that I'm very narcissistic or ego made. I mean, that's all fair enough, but at least I'm a little bit aware of it and self-critical, but it's going to attract a certain, it's going to attract a certain person. I mean, one thing that I would say, and I'm not, I mean, when I heard, like, you know, that recording that someone made of me just like lashing out in bombastic manner, you know, that was me, I think also kind of in a state of fear, in a way as well, because, you know, it's not fun anymore.
I hate hearing that.
Because
I thought this is a guy who's realizing in real time that he is being converted into a hate figure.
Yeah.
On that day, it was a horrible thing to hear.
And there's a lot of fear in there, and there's a bruised ego. There's lashing out. I obviously wish that had not been, you know, secretly recorded and then revealed. But regardless, maybe it should have been in a way. It was a real thing. So I mean, I think you have to, you know, you have to be honest and self-critical about that kind of situation. But look, I also see things where people were interested. They were magnetized to the alt-right because they could get into fights with people, and that was part of it. And you know, you see that even with to take another example, just so we can be a little more objective on it, like the Rittenhouse situation, where you have this one of the men that he killed is just this totally bizarre person. I think he might even have been a child abuser.
This is one of the things that made me realize it's the same on the left.
Yeah.
It's really fringe types.
Moth to a flame. Like, and maybe even Rittenhouse himself didn't have, or, you know, I don't want to go down this, but look, your mother allows a 17-year-old kid to go to a violent rally. I mean, I don't know. But put that aside. Like a moth to a flame, there's a certain type of person that sees that chaos energy and just can't get enough of it. And, you know, they've secretly been desiring to beat people's faces in, and they want to see blood, and they're just attracted to it. It's a huge, huge issue. And we're all like that on some level. You know, people go to a football game to see a big hit or wrestling matches. So that's a human problem, but I think in some people it's extremely pronounced. And I think the path forward is to be, you know, radically violent in philosophy and in ideology, and when it's a little too real, it's going to bring out some bad things in yourself, but also you're going to be able to have the blame foisted on you because you were the front man. You were leading it. You were the visible quality of it. And so you're going to take the blame for all of these invisible qualities. And so unless you have just millions at your reserve and just a total backstop of lawyers, et cetera, it's a bad move. And so, you know, that is certainly one lesson that I learned. Yes.
Yeah. There is a loss of that disagreeableness there for sure. As you say, there's, I think, one of the cliches about Antifa, and we've both had our run-ins with Antifa.
Yes.
Mine not as dramatic as yours, perhaps, but still.
I'm sure they've come to your home. It's even scarier.
That was very scary. I mean, some people have mocked me for that. I think some people would be okay with it. They'd handle it better. I think for me, it was such a violation at that time. You know, that it definitely very much disturbed me. But you've been physically assaulted by them, and as yet that hasn't happened to me, and that actually disgusted me. I remember doing a video at the time about it, that was their idea of heroism, you know, to just show up out of nowhere. You've got no chance to respond, no chance to defend yourself. That was just disgusting. But again, we're talking about people who are, you've only got to look at
there were some bad people, as Trump didn't say, there were bad people on both sides. There were some people on our side who liked it. They wouldn't do it quite in that way, although they kind of did in a way. I mean, Nathan D'Amico punched that woman. I mean, it was, I think it was a ambiguous situation. I mean, maybe he was, I don't want to judge him legally, but we all loved it. We all got, we all kind of saw that demonic urge kind of came up in us.
Yes. And there was a sense of justice that this,
yeah.
This has been dealt with. This source of chaos has been responded to, but yeah, that's obviously a very emotional thing. It's not, so I wouldn't want to, you know, defend that or advocate it, because that's just, it's just not reasonable. But I understand that a lot of people saw that and felt a sort of triumph.
Yeah.
But, you know, the opposition, look how much triumphalism there was about you getting punched. You know, it's everyone is capable of this. And I think some are more capable of it than others. But yeah, with Nathan D'Amico, I honestly don't know what happened there. I'm not commenting on that. But yeah, it was definitely an interesting time, I think, for everyone involved in it. Let me see if there are any questions based on this, because it seems like a relevant time. Okay. What was your view on why Trump's election in 2016 divided the whole right-wing sphere? Was the energy just to elect him and then we didn't know what to do next? Similar to Occupy Wall Street that fizzled out.
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy, actually, with Occupy Wall Street, which absolutely fizzled. And remember, was literally occupying New York for a time there. I mean, that remarkable stuff and kind of largely forgotten. I think there's I've actually visited Occupy Wall Street when I was in New York City. This was back, I guess, in 2011 or 2012.
I think it was 10, 11.
Yeah. And it was kind of crazy. It's very interesting. Like they, sleeping in tents and I'm sure just having sex with each other, all the time, the smell, the weird, like passing paperback books around and like these girls dancing with like glow objects and just kind of like totally out of it.
I love how
interesting stuff.
As if there's something bad about paperback books.
it was just no. It was just kind of weird. It was like they had a library or something of these like moldy paperbacks on it. I just remember it for whatever reason. But yeah, no, that was the least of their crimes, I guess.
I remember hearing rumors that there was rape going on and this kind of thing and drugs.
I'm sure that was happening.
God knows.
But yeah, I think that was the case. That Trump was the unifying figure that brought everything together, but all of these people didn't really much like each other to begin with, and so it was an uneasy alliance that lasted a year and a half. You know?
Yeah. I should say that someone has said in the live chat about the D'Amico incident that I was there, that bitch was throwing bottles into the crowd. That's it. I remember now that hearing that at the time, that it was that she was actually, that was why he did that.
Fair enough. I mean, it was a melee. You know, our point was just that, was simply that there was that chaos energy kind of on both sides and even within us. Like it was on the edge.
Yeah. Okay, I'll just go through the super chats and just in the order that they were submitted, because it's going to be chaotic anyway, so we might as well just jump through around the topics. What is Spencer's attitude towards the dissident right now, and why did you take a step back? Thanks to the hipster whisperer for delivering us this extra special guest. Happy New Year, guys. I think I must be the hipster whisperer. Thank you. So what is your attitude towards the dissident right? And I think you've talked about why you took a step back. So what do you think about the situation now?
I guess I have mixed feelings, and there's some people who I'm cool on and some people who I learn from. I mean, you know, Academic Agent and I have had some great conversations and so on. So I can learn from people. Some people, even who I find kind of vaguely interesting, BAP, for example, who I don't ultimately like, and I kind of as a Nietzschean, I reject him as well. But I'm not even like inherently antagonistic towards, but I feel the antagonism constantly. So I'm just kind of like, okay, you know, if you say so, we're mortal enemies or whatever. It's a mixed bag, and I guess I am a little bit bored with the endless trolling in the sense that it was fresh and new you know, in 2016, it was just absolutely hilarious. I think now it kind of clangs a bit. But
the other thing is that we're getting older. I mean, you and I are not in our 20s.
And we're 17. Yeah.
It can be fucking irritating. You know?
Yes. Yeah. And I guess I've gotten some appreciation. I mean, it's funny because I used to really despise Nick Fuentes when he was attacking me. But now that there's no attack, I can have a certain appreciation. I mean, we have profound disagreements, but he's experienced many of the things that I've experienced. He's a weird kid. He's actually open-minded. You can talk to him. Now, when he's on a comedic routine I see some of these clips that I do find rather funny or sometimes like the, listen, guys, having sex with women, that's gay. That's gay. You know, that's obviously I find that funny or whatever. Tons of stuff I don't disagree. I disagree with and I reject. But I would say he's better than a lot of his fans. He can actually listen and he has a brain in his head. He's an interesting figure, but I don't know. I'm just at a point where I don't really see myself as part of a broader movement, coherent, that's moving towards a goal, like electing Trump, period. I don't see myself as part of that. And so I take what's interesting to me and leave stuff that isn't.
Yeah, so there's not that sense that you've got to sort of curate the space.
Or be nice to everyone to keep it together. Yeah. I'm their politician or representative. No, I don't feel that way.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same nowadays. I mean, it's an ungovernable space anyway, because of the things we're talking about. I do agree with you about Fuentes. He and I fell out back in late 2017, and he's said some shitty things about me since then. I've said a few bitchy things in response.
Sure.
Yeah, it happens. I think he's learning, like some other people of a similar age in the movement, he's learning now that it's actually better to have allies. It's actually useful to have allies. It's fun to just go out alone and piss over everyone else. It's fun, but it leaves you very vulnerable.
You want some reasonable voice that will defend you, even if you're in the wrong, you know. But someone who'll be like, all right, guys, let's put this into perspective. You know, you ultimately do want that, I would say. Yes. You can't take a knife to the back of everyone.
No, surprisingly enough. Okay, Rick says, the first video of yours, I think he means me, that I ever saw was Spencer's 2016 millennial appearance, back when I was a normie. Feels cozy to come full circle all these years later. Hard to believe that I didn't even know that Klaus Schwab was a Rothschild back then. That's a reference to an in-joke. Okay. Well, yeah, there is a certain coming full circle sense about this, which is one of the reasons to invite Spencer on. Mm-hmm. Not finished, says Keir. Oh, yes, this is the thing that you resemble Keir Starmer in some ways, or Keir Starmer resembles you in some ways. Do you know who Keir Starmer is?
Oh, do I know who he is? I mean, around 2040, I entered a reverse entropy machine. And so while I'm moving forward in time as we know it, the other version of myself is actually moving backwards. And so I learned at that point that it was necessary for me to become the Labour Party leader of Great Britain in the 2024-2025 period. And so it's been an ongoing project. But if we do ever meet, that could be a kind of universe-ending, you know, cataclysm is the only worry.
That sounds as convoluted as a Christopher Nolan storyline.
Right.
Have you seen Tenet?
Yeah, I saw Tenet.
I really didn't like it. I've got to
it was kind of unwatchable on some level. I literally could not hear what they were saying. And I thought that was like the movie theater in Montana or whatever. I was like, it must be just that, but no. It is inaudible, literally, you know, actually. And
no one does this deliberately. I heard him say it about what was the one book, the space one, Interstellar.
Oh, Interstellar, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
I think Nolan is great, though. I think there's a lot of interest in Tenet, and I think he might have been saying something. I remember Mark Berman and I talked about that for a little bit. We were kind of maybe grasping at something. I mean, I think he is trying to say something. I mean, I think Inception is a very interesting as well, what he might be saying there, even with that figure of Robert Fisher, Bobby Fisher.
I think he's one of the best directors operating today. I can't really think of anyone else that I really don't like modern films, but I really liked the second Batman film with the Joker and Two-Face, specifically Two-Face, more than the Joker. The Joker was fine. I'm not going to say that Heath Ledger was crap. It was good. Of course, it was very good. But I really liked the Two-Face stuff and the development of that. I thought it was great. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. All right.
I've kind of been delving into Kubrick a lot recently. I do find... I do love Kubrick, you know, in my way. And a lot of... I think Kubrick is really misunderstood, actually. I think some of the messaging is even kind of darker than you might imagine, actually.
That's interesting. I've always been a huge fan of Kubrick. And there was actually a Kubrick exhibition in London a couple of years ago that I went to, and I saw the sculptures from A Clockwork Orange of the naked women and all that. I saw the typewriter from The Shining.
Wow. Adler.
It was amazing stuff. And also the lenses that they used for Barry Lyndon, which are kind of famous.
It's funny. So we just did this thing on my Substack that I would encourage anyone, if you want to give me money. We went into kind of mid-period Kubrick. So we started with Dr. Strangelove, and then we actually did Eyes Wide Shut, but we did Barry Lyndon, we did Clockwork Orange, and 2001. We have a very particular perspective on it, but yes, I'm very much into that stuff. I love it.
Yeah.
Modern directors suck, yeah. Nolan's the only, you're right, Nolan's the only one of kind of interest that you want to, you feel like you need to go see it, and like, what is he trying to tell you, etc. I don't think there's anyone else like that.
And also the construct, he's very good at plot. I know I think it's his brother who writes the scripts, I can't remember, but the plotting of Interstellar I thought was fantastic. It was so clever with the Tesseract and the timed stuff. I thought it was just great. I really enjoyed it. I mean, the film obviously has flaws. It does overreach a bit, but I thought it was still a great film. All right, here's another political question. And this is a bit thorny, but it's interesting. What lessons can nationalists learn from the collapse of the National Justice Party?
Oh. Well, I think all the lessons that we've already discussed about disagreeable people and so on, I think there are a couple bigger lessons with that. There are also some kind of cheap, peculiar lessons that I think are endemic to just TRS in general, that it's pretty vulgar stuff, guys. And I don't, the moving from being a shock jock to you're going to vote for me for president, at least conceivably, not sure about that. I think the other thing is that you can't be a populist without being popular. And the popularity of like an alt-right podcast is very limited, whereas with Trump, his, you know, all of those things, like Trump went on World Wrestling, and Trump, you know, fired people on The Apprentice, and Trump was, I remember when I was a kid in the 80s, When my mother would take me to the grocery store, there'd be like People, these are American magazines, like People, Us Weekly, the National Enquirer, whatever, they're all up there. And it would just be like Trump, Marla Maples, Trump, Ivanka, you know, Trump bankrupt, you know. He was just like part of my life in some kind of crazy way. The best sex I ever had, you know, that headline from the New York Post. So all of those things allowed him to succeed. And so you can't just create populism of like, you know, the Jews are bad and Wall Street's bad and we're going to give you money or what. It's kind of a LARP, to be honest. Like populism, at very least in the United States, it does focus around figures, whether it's Donald Trump or William Jennings Bryan, who's actually a misunderstood man in many ways. The guy from Inherit the Wind, actually an interesting progressive, but anyway, it's not going to work. And I think the other, a kind of darker lesson that I learned, I remember on January 6th and people were showing me in a group that I'm involved in, they were showing me text or Telegram messages from TRS. And it was like, you know, today we made our first strike against the Jews. And, you know, Ashley Babbitt is the martyr in an ongoing cause where Hitler left off, you know, Ashley came. I mean, it was insane. And, you know, we need to be willing to lose 40 million like the Germans did in this cause. I just on and on of this kind of stuff. And look, first off, all of that's ridiculous. Ashley Babbitt was motivated by Trump and QAnon. And she was not motivated by you. She's not part of your cause, et cetera. But I think there's also even a kind of like darker thing that I learned of who are the real Nazis. So you have NJP as this, you know, outrageous alt-right 2016, you know, group, like, you know, we like Hitler, you know, ha ha. You know, I'm not misrepresenting them by saying that. They're vulgar and outlandish and a little bit fashy or a lot fashy. But it was actually the mainstream deluded boomers who attempted to take over the government. So while Mike and Stryker were on a podcast sitting at home, all of those deluded boomer conservatives were almost accomplished and maintaining Trump in power against the wishes of the mainstream media, both political parties, the military. I mean, look, that whole thing was buffoonish as hell, but it almost worked. And they did it, not you. So I would ask, who are the real Nazis here? Is it the person who will freely drop an N-bomb or deny the Holocaust? Or is it, in fact, the deluded boomer who was part of something bigger than herself that she had no control of and in a way acted unconsciously and almost flipped the election? So I think that's a kind of analytical point. It's not really a personal jab, but it's kind of like, who's more radical? Is it the mainstream boomers or is it TRS listeners? And I would actually say that the mainstream is more radical than a lot of the alt-right. So, you know, it just is what it is. You can look back on it now and say they shouldn't have done it. Okay, but that's retrospective. I don't really want to bash anyone, to be honest. Like, I, you know, Mike's smart and he can be funny and vulgar, and I feel like I think with those guys, I think the bridge is burned from both ends. So I don't know if I even really want to do any, you know. I'm glad that we can break bread, you know, so to speak, here, but I'm not sure that I would ever really do that with TRS people or if I'd want to, but I don't want to bash them too bad. You know, they took an L, it's okay. I've taken L's. Maybe it was ill-conceived, but can you learn from this and kind of learn deeper lessons? I think that's the big question.
Yeah. There's a lot that I could say there, but I don't want to use up time with my own opinions. Okay, Not Finished said, 2024 isn't 2016. The rules have changed. The stakes are higher. If you've read The Art of the Deal, Trump gives multiple examples in which he gets revenge. But these examples convey weakness. His revenge is weak. Why should anyone believe that he will do what is needed? I think that,
that's kind of interesting. What I would be curious to, I read the art of the deal. It's been a number of years, but that's kind of interesting on the revenge thing. I mean, Trump is promising revenge and he's promising collective revenge. He's saying, I am your retribution or your, what did he say? Your, I'm revenge, even,
yeah,
you know,
the like dark he, that's, stuff, I think.
Yeah, dark mag. But he said it at CPAC and everyone was like, woo, woo, you know, revenge, yeah. So someone in my Substack group was saying, they're like, you know, Trump, there are two wolves living in Trump. Like one of them wants to just burn it all down and get seek revenge. And another one really wants to be loved. And Trump can be manipulated by those. Like if he goes in there and people say, well, you won this time, you know, congratulations, you're the president. And all those legal problems, they're gone for at least a little while. And we're going to work with you. I think he would probably go along with it because he does desperately want to be loved. But yeah, I could also see it going the other way. there's a plan hatched by the Heritage Foundation, I believe, of just firing like 2/3 of the federal workforce and so on. So they also, the conservatives and Trump conservatives have also, some of them have learned some lessons. And so I do think it would be different, but I also wonder whether 2024 is the last election in the United States. And I mean that very seriously in the sense that whichever side wins, the other side won't treat it as legitimate. I mean, when Mar-a-Lago was raided, you had a guy go to the FBI with a gun, and you know, it was one guy, a lone wolf, but it happened. Are you going to have some sort of lashing out on a wide scale if Biden wins? You know, it was stolen. You want to make us trans. You want to do this or that. You're going to betray Israel. Whatever's in their mind. You can kind of see that happening. And you could definitely see that happening on the left. I mean, look, BLM was not an kind of, you know, it was different than J6, but it was kind of the same quality. And even the liberals recognize at some point that this is getting out of hand. This isn't just, you know, people in the suburbs washing black people's feet and singing Kumbaya and talking about George Floyd. It was getting to a point of general instability. So they are capable of that. And so I guess the way I view it is that I think there's a very strong chance that this is really the end of a paradigm in general. And I don't know what to say. It's out of my control, but I can just see it. When there's masses of people don't think the government's illegitimate, that really is that, you know, follow the Soviet Union, American Civil War, whatever. It can go in all sorts of different ways, but it's going to go in one of those ways. I think if anything, Joe Biden proved that we cannot go back to normalcy, that because I think he generally wanted that, maybe just due to the fact that he's old and white, you know, that he just wanted to have everyone on board. We're all going to forgive each other. And I don't think that's possible. I think these things are too far gone at this point. And so I do think that something that we can't even quite envision now is possible just around the corner.
That's interesting. There have been several people saying, I've seen quite a few memes recently about how back in the old days, like the 2000s, even certainly the 90s and certainly the 80s, America, and this also is certainly true of Britain and I guess every Western country, people could be friends who were not politically aligned. People could even have relationships with someone from... mind you, you've done that yourself recently.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I think of it. But it's not a common thing. I mean, most people, it's very politicized. And I think this is just the tenor of the age where, as someone said, the stakes are very high now. And, yeah, tensions are very high. So
it's bigger than race. So at least according to polling, conservative men are more fearful of their daughter marrying a Democrat than they are of their daughter marrying a Black or et cetera. I mean, it's in, that's a poll. So maybe they're not willing to say what they really, fair enough, but it's still powerful. And like large percentages, you found like 40% believe that violence is necessary, or it's just crazy. The polls shock me. Like I expect a poll to just demonstrate like how boring the American public is, but in actuality, they deny the Holocaust and want to kill their neighbors. It's like, whoa.
Exactly. It's like you're the one saying, "Calm down." Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. You see these polls, and you think, "Fuck, it's crazy out there." The ordinary public are not. They're not the boring people of the 20, 30 years ago anymore.
No.
They want radical change in society.
Yeah.
This is definitely more true in America than Britain, but it's true here as well. Mm-hmm. The old, as you say, the old stability is it cannot come back, and people don't really want it back either, because the injustices are so extreme now that, the correction is going to, of whatever nature it takes, is going to be extreme as well. So
yeah, and I think so, even someone as boring as Jordan Peterson is kind of right, where it's like, there is a crisis of meaning in our country. Like, he's kind of right about that. And I think, QAnon filled that hole, and woke can fill that hole, and extreme anti-white animosity can fill that hole, or pro-Palestinian nationalism can fill that hole. But I agree. I think there's just a profound crisis of meaning. In the United States, it was just taken for granted that you were a patriotic WASP, effectively. And you could be Jewish, you could be Catholic, you could even be an atheist, but you're just, at the end of the day, you were a Protestant. And that was a national religion. And there is no separation of church and state. That is a total illusion of some Thomas Jefferson or something. The church and the state, this spirit and authority are one. And when one starts to fade away and you don't have it, there's really an issue of like, where is this going to go? And I think that's where the United States public is at the moment.
Yeah, it throws everything into doubt, and you've mm-hmm. got anarchy, or latent, the impending anarchy. I do mm-hmm. think that's what is in store for certainly undoubtedly America, and I think the rest of us as well. Okay, yeah. Indian Bronson recently tweeted about the border crisis, saying it's over for the US and that it's not possible to change things since the electorate has been transformed. What's your opinion on that?
I think that's an overstatement. I mean, the border crisis, remember, illegal immigrants, say what you will about them, and I do think that it's a huge problem. They will often go back. Very often it's seasonal. Very often it's living in the shadows for a very long time. Very often it's abusing the emergency care system of hospitals, fair enough. Very seldom is it voting and abuse of taxes. You could kind of go both ways on that. Like, they do pay taxes, in fact, and they're not going to collect Social Security or Medicare for God's sake. So I don't know. It's kind of a wash on that side. But no, I don't. I think Trump is going to win. I don't know what to say. So I don't think that the demographic has been totally transformed. And I actually think there's a tremendous amount of Hispanic support for Trump. In fact, I don't quite buy that kind of doomsaying.
All right. Okay. Someone asked about, so Andrew Anglin denounced Nick Fuentes for,
talking to me, yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if he now does the same to me. But,
he hasn't already? I mean, I can't believe you...
Maybe he has, I don't know. I don't know. difficult to keep
track. I just don't see him liking you, and I mean that as a compliment.
Well, I think he actually did.
Oh, okay.
We've had one text conversation, or maybe two. And yeah, but we clearly do come from very different mentalities. So mm-hmm. yeah, I've not got any particular beef with him, but yeah, he probably will denounce me for this. But the thing is, as I said last night when I announced your appearance, I don't see this as sort of trying to re-inaugurate you as the leader of the dissident right or whatever, because I don't think you want that. Mm. So no, exactly. It's very much catching up with an old friend. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea. So Unknown Californian asks, living in Montana, has Richard ever had a Sasquatch encounter, or does he know anyone who has?
Well, I've encountered a number of people in costume as Sasquatch, sometimes even on the ski slope. I've never seen a Sasquatch. I've been very close to some bears, off and on, sometimes in a car and sometimes not. But yeah, the whole Sasquatch thing, kind of fascinating. I remember my ex-wife got into Bigfoot at one point, and there's this guy in Utah, and he's a Mormon and a scientist, but he is like a true believing Sasquatch scientist, and he's become like the Kevin McDonald of his university for his like Sasquatchism, because he's like trying to prove it. I'm kind of not joking. Like I remember seeing this video that she showed me. This is like 10 years ago. Right? And they would interview his colleagues and they're like, I really don't want to talk about, you know, whatever his name. Like it's just very disturbing that he believes these things. So, I don't know. I'm kind of a skeptic type, but I don't go in for the alien stuff. I find all that stuff just inherently bullshitty. That a lot of the Tucker Carlson's been promoting, that Grush. And I saw that interview and his testimony for Congress, and I just saw that as BS in a can. But so I don't really go in for that stuff. But Sasquatch, that would be cool if it's true.
That's what I think. It's the same with the Loch Ness Monster. It would be so cool if these things were true. But
a dinosaur that survived, like a community of dinosaurs that survived the meteor or something, and they're living in Scotland. That is definitely, I want that to
in this
happen.
Dark, cold lake. You know, it's so atmospheric. It's so cool. Yeah, I'd love it if these things were true, and various other things, you know, vampires and werewolves and mm-hmm. all that. But yeah, I'm not gonna live my life as if these things are true. As for aliens. I think there must be life on other planets. I mean, there has to be. Just
in the universe. Yeah.
It just must be true. But I've never seen anything or whatever. No.
Yeah. And it's actually kind of disturbing, because you would need faster than light travel for us to have any sort of contact. And then there's an even disturbing thing of, was there a life form of some sort a billion years ago that went extinct? And we're at a moment where we could receive contact, or even even approach them, but we're displaced in time, and so on. So I agree with the general premise that there must be life is unusual, but it must have happened somewhere. I agree. Even a plant life or something, like there must be something, but. It's even kind of disturbing of like we couldn't even quite make contact with them, even if they did exist.
Yeah. Their mode of communication might be so different as well. That's another factor. It's very interesting. Of course, this is why one of the reasons science fiction is so enduringly fascinating to people. Mm-hmm. Someone's quoted some. It's a super chat that's just some Depeche Mode lyrics. The topic of Depeche Mode would come up.
Yeah, you guys should check. So today we're going to release, I'm going to actually release two Depeche Mode podcasts. And these are free. They're for the public. My Christmas gift to the world. I think we discussed Sounds of the Universe and then Some Great Reward album. The Sounds of the Universe podcast, I listened to it because I put in like music cues and things like that. And it was, I was like, I've got to release two because we both agree that Sounds of the Universe is not good. And so I don't want to just, you know, give people a downer. So I also do the Some Great Reward. Yeah. But we're kind of going through the whole, Andrew Jensen and I are going through the whole album, the 15 of them or whatever. And we're doing like the, we're meeting, like Keir Starmer and I are meeting at 2030. We'll be the same age, or that's what we're doing. So we're starting with Memento Mori and Speak and Spell, and then we're switching off and we'll meet at Songs of Faith and Devotion. But yeah, no, doing this and sitting down and listening to them on vinyl, and not just listening to them like when I'm at the gym or something, but just sitting down and like reading it like a novel, just sitting down with the album. Yeah, my love has increased, actually. And so, yeah, they're absolutely my favorite band of all time, 20th century. I love their, they really speak to me. And yeah, I love the pain of Black Celebration. There's nothing to celebrate, but we're just going to suffer through it and get to the end of it. And we can look back at it from the other side of this pain. Yes, it really appeals to me. It appeals to me since the first time I heard that album, which I believe, I know memory's faulty, you can create memories, but my older sister, who's 5 years older than I, was listening to that album, let's say 1986 or 7. I mean,
it was released in 86. Yeah.
It was released in 86. So I was around, like, let's say 9 or 10. And just hearing this, like, listening to Stripped, or this, like, you know, repetitive lyric, this like industrial sound, minor key, a baritone, you know, Dave Gahan's voice. I was just like, I didn't know music could be like this. And
it sounds incredible. The production, yeah, that's my favorite Depeche album. And
that's mine too. That's mine too. Black Celebration. Yes.
Yeah.
It's just pure Depeche Mode. It's not Andrews, but it's just, it just is what it's black on black. It's listenable enough. There's great, you know, lyrics and melodies, but then it has a little bit of that clanging industrial. You can just see them, like, in the video, like slamming a sledgehammer into a car outside of the Berlin Wall.
The production is so off that moment as well, and that's one of the things that gives it the beauty. It's that sampling digital, but it's still cold, you know, warm. It's lovely. Yeah. And as you say, the attitude of the album, the atmosphere of it. My favorite song is But Not Tonight. And I'm not actually sure originally.
That was a B-side.
Right. Fantastic song. I can't believe it's not more widely known.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the life-affirming version of Black Celebration, because it's a Black Celebration. Like, we've seen the back of another black day. It's like, you know, my eyes were bloodshot, but I'm embracing life. And yeah, I think, but not some, that's a great song. I love it.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Let me see the next. Okay. K-Max. We've already asked that one. Okay. Someone's asking about, I'm not going to ask that because that's a personal question. Okay. K-Max asks, what was the atmosphere on the Duke University campus when he went there? The Duke lacrosse scandal was ripe in the media at that time.
Yeah.
Later, a journalist revealed that we media types did not care that they were innocent. We just wanted these rich white guys to suffer for their privilege.
It was crazy. I mean, I met Stephen Miller at the time. We were at Duke at the same time. It's kind of crazy. We actually did a conference together where we did an immigration conference and brought Peter Brimelow to campus. A lot of this stuff is known, actually, but it's kind of fascinating when you think about it. He was an undergraduate. I was a graduate student. But yeah, I mean, I remember this was 2005 or six. So it earlier internet era, but pre-cell iPhone and so on. But I even remember when the police released things from emails from their computer, and it was one of these lacrosse bros who was broing out over American Psycho, and he was like, "Oh yeah, we should bring over the prostitutes and skin them alive, and you know, have sex with their corpses." It just some totally outrageous comment, but very, very typical of a 20-year-old or a 40-year-old for that matter, just a bro comment. And they put that out as the police release that to the public as if it were evidence. Evidence of what? Bad taste or whatever? That's not a confession of anything. He didn't, in fact, skin anyone alive. So this is nonsense. They're just trying to smear them. And I remember walking out on campus and everyone had seen that at the same time. And just everyone was just on edge. There was just like a mood that you could feel. It was remarkable. I mean, at the end, it was a victory as well. It was every day the media was, there's a media storm, the circus of all of these big trucks doing their reports. You could walk to class, someone would be reporting from campus. I mean, it was a wild situation. I've had a few of these situations. I was in New York City during 9/11. I was at Duke for the lacrosse case. I was at Trump and the alt-right. I mean, I don't know. Maybe people shouldn't invite me to their home because it might, you know, burn down or something. I don't know. It was really crazy to think about it in retrospect.
Yeah. Because that was a big, big thing at the time. Mm-hmm. The Duke lacrosse case. One of those early... Well, yeah, there had been precursors to it, but yeah, that was...
It was definitely wokeism on campus as well. I mean, that was an early version of that, because I remember many of the professors, that there was one line that was written by a guy who I think was like the dean of something, and it was like, even if the lacrosse boys are innocent, you know, it reveals the like... you know, greater white supremacy on campus. So there was even this kind of like, the facts don't matter about my feelings. I mean, it all explicitly stated. Pretty fascinating.
I remember that. And it was the same with the Covington School kids. If that's, mm-hmm. Is that the right word? The same thing was said, but that's a lot, a long time mm-hmm. later. But yeah, it's this idea of post-truth. It doesn't matter whether this specific, don't get waylaid with the details. it's the general point that it shows.
Which they're right. It's the power of narrative, you know?
Yes. The general truths are.
I mean, I don't think there was actually a Jesus Christ, but I don't think there was a Hamlet either. I think both of those are literary figures, but they're immensely powerful to the point that there is a reality to it. I mean, Jesus does exist and live. Because of his power. And so I would stress that it's good to debunk things, of course, like you should use facts and logic, etc. But don't get too enamored with that. You know, reason's a whore. And facts don't matter at the end of the day.
Yes. I completely agree. It's a profound thing, but I'll not say anything. It's just, I agree. Otherwise, you know, if we had more time, I would, but we've got some questions to ask. Mm-hmm. All right. Does Bronze Age Pervert faithfully interpret Nietzsche?
No, God. He interprets Nietzsche like he's 15 years old or something. Nietzsche's, if what you take from Nietzsche is be a badass or whatever, I mean, that's there, you know, granted, but no, absolutely not. I could not finish the book. I was just kind of, yeah.
I love the idea that something like that boils down to be a badass. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I keep saying that I'm going to read the dissertation. I need to be able to criticize people seriously and not engage in superficial jabs. So let me try to force myself to read his dissertation, which is available on Amazon.
Okay. All right. K-Max, how different would Charlottesville have been if the first night with the tiki torches happened and then everyone went home? It was the Saturday seemed to destroy things, but not the Friday night. How does Richard view this?
Fair enough, but remember, there was more violence on Friday night than even I perceived, and I was there. There was a bit of a melee. So, I don't know. This is kind of like saying, you know, if Hitler didn't invade Poland, or you know, if if John F. Kennedy had put the top up of the convertible or something, you know, I guess I kind of agree, but it happened.
Yeah. And it was always going to happen given what you knew at the
time. Yeah. There would have been another Charlottesville after that. If Charlottesville had been viewed as a success, there would have been an even bigger one in which two people had died. And yeah.
Yeah. All right. Not Finished says, Donald Trump doesn't represent populism. To think that is laughable. However, he does represent a crack in the current political narrative. He represents the tide of ethno-nationalism that will drown the current Western multi-culti globalist ideology that is despised, but in power, if he is allowed to, if he is let. Yeah, I think that's what he said.
He obviously represents populism. I mean, give me a break. I'm not sure he really represents ethno-nationalism, actually. I think
not
that's
consciously.
A bit of... Not consciously, and maybe not ultimately. We are reaching 2 hours. I might have to, unfortunately, get going pretty soon, but it is an interesting question. To some degree, he represents a kind of white nationalism, of course, but I think that can be deceptive to read him like that. He obviously represents populism, and I actually agree that he is a danger to the system. That's why it's just kind of amazing we live in the age of Trump even now.
Yes.
Incredible. He's the most impactful human being on the planet. I mean, you can say that about Napoleon and Jesus and Martin Luther and a few, like, very few figures.
Yes. All right. So briefly, what does Richard think about Patriot Front and active clubs?
I don't really want to join. I mean, look, I'm not against, you know, doing your thing. If you want to go out there and do stuff, you are putting a target on your back. And I think with PF, there gets to a point where it's kind of like, well, why, you know, like, why are you marching right now? You know, what is your cause? What do you believe in? And I'm not going to join them, but I don't really have anything. Like, I'm not against it, any of this stuff, if you want to go out and do your thing. So yeah, that's my opinion.
Is active clubs the one where they're all dressed in red with the sunglasses and the guy's got tattoos down one side of his head?
Oh, that's okay. Okay,
I didn't know who they were.
The Blood Tribe.
Yeah. Oh, the Blood Tribe. That was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That looked pretty far
out. Not sure they're accomplishing much. Yes, they are right wing, I would suggest. Yes. If the swastika tattoo didn't give it away, they.
Okay, Francis says, only jumping in to compliment Richard for being an excellent source of contrary but still well-reasoned and thought-out perspectives. That's good. Thank you very much. Someone asks a hamburger-related question.
Ah, oh, good, yes.
Okay.
My favorite hamburger, yeah.
Yes.
Still caramelized onions, yeah. You can't eat them.
All right.
Mushroom Swiss cheese, yeah. I do not understand why I get dragged for this. Correct opinion.
I know. I think it was just the tenor of it at the time. okay. Groypers are the ideological descendants of Buchananism blended with elements of the alt-right.
To some degree, I kind of disagree with that, though. I think that Buchanan was genuinely trying to revive an America that existed in his childhood. I think Groypers exist where America, like the America first that they're defending, is like a half-remembered dream or something that never existed. I remember one of the first times I ever saw Nick Fuentes, he was being, it was one of his shows, I guess, a stream, and he was attacking, you know, I don't know, some slut or whatever. And he was like, guys, we're going back, drive-in movie theaters, milkshake, pizza socials, like, we're going back to it. And it's like, dude, you're 17 years old, you know, like, what, how, when did you ever drink a milkshake at a drugstore with Betty, you know, on the other aisle? Like, you watched an episode of Happy Days is what you did. And so you're a rerun has become a memory for you, and a rerun of a show that was in fact a parody of the 1950s that came out in the 70s and 80s. And I do think that, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, joking a little bit here, but it gets to a point. I do think that Buchanan was defending something real. And I think the Groypers, for better and for worse, are kind of pushing that chaos towards something new. Yeah, I would say that. But I think that a real distinction should be made. They're not conservatives.
Yeah, well, there's nothing. They're trying to recreate something.
Yeah.
Thin Red Line. Oh, no, Potato Mutt. I'm not going to ask that because I think it's... I think it's a joke question. Thin Red Line. There was a lot of euphoria in 2016 and people wanted everything to happen instantly, but we want to bring down an empire and, of course, it will take time. The truth is, though, we were not at all ready to take power in 2016. Probably we are still not ready, but we are getting closer. That's a nice optimistic note mm-hmm. there. I asked ChatGPT what good optics meant, and it gave me a link to one of your top five Spencer moments.
Okay, oh my God, that's funny.
Let me see which one it is. Oh, it's the Enjoy the Silence.
Oh, the Depeche Mode style. Yeah, Enjoy the Silence. Yeah, wow. That is, well, it's true. I mean, you know, AI is right on this. Yeah, that was good optics. Having fun.
I thought it was good. You know, I really liked it at the time.
Good music choice, yeah.
Richard, are there any questions that could be answered, problems to be overcome to get you to stop fearing and start loving the Torah?
No, I guess. I do kind of fear its power. I guess that's fair enough. But I, in a way, love it. One thing that when you become critical of something and when you see the layers, it almost becomes more interesting to me. I've read more of the Torah over the past 3 years than I read when I was a child. I'm ashamed to say, in a way, because I just found it dusty. I didn't understand what was going on. You know, just a bunch of guys and camels and, well, you know, whatever. But now I want to read it critically. So,
It becomes relevant and therefore it's interesting.
Exactly.
It's amazing how that happens. I've been doing a lot of research stuff recently as well. And suddenly something that you would never have been interested in is fascinating. Okay, I'll rush through just the last few questions here.
Yeah.
Why do you no longer advocate galactic Lebensraum?
Do I not?
Okay, I said former advocate, but maybe someone's... infer too much from that. Okay, and then there were a few questions, and just these are sort of trivial, jokey questions to end with. Mm-hmm. Are you a cat or a dog person?
I'm a dog person. I'm allergic to cats, and cats kind of they scare me a little bit. They're a little. It's like they're being sarcastic to you or something, whereas a dog is never sarcastic.
Right. Okay. And do you still favor the fash cut hairstyle?
Sort of. No, we can't go back to that, guys. We got to move forward to new hairstyles.
All right. Okay. Well, I think there's that. Oh, and someone else asked, what's your favorite film of all time?
It's hard. I'll just name a few. I'll break the... I think Sunset Boulevard is maybe the greatest American movie ever made. I love that movie. Love rewatching it. I love Kubrick films. I would love to rewatch 2001, Eyes Wide Shut, Clockwork. I would love to just rewatch those right now. I love James Bond movies. On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I'll need to watch that on New Year's Eve. It's kind of a personal tradition of mine. But there are a number of other James Bond films that I love. John Ford's The Searchers. That I really love that movie.
I remember you did a Radix podcast about The Searchers back in like 2013.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, it was 10 years ago.
Not a long time ago, but I'm
sure. I would like to do that again and kind of revisit it. But it's a very American film. It's about genocide, and it's a it's about a hero who is cast out at the end. It's a very disturbing film. It's not what you would expect of like John Wayne, you know, walking around. But I also appreciate John Wayne as an actor. That's another thing. He's not just a cardboard cutout. It's a deep film.
All right. Thank you, Richard Spencer, for this. This has been very interesting indeed.
I'm glad this happened. Yeah.
Yeah, so am I. I think this has been good. I think it's been good for everyone, I think. Are there any final things you'd like to say before we finish off?
No, just have a good New Year's, and I wish you all the best in 2024. Let's see what happens. We can drink our eggnog or champagne while the world burns. Maybe that's going to be 2024.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you have any predictions for 2024? But we've kind of touched on those.
The last election in American history. Yeah, that's my... I mean...
All right, and forces unleashed that we cannot understand.
All right. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This has been a great talk.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it very much. So thank you, everyone, for taking part. Richard Spencer, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023. All right. See you later.
See ya.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.